right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right, I'm back again and again and again. All right, so we're getting to know each other. I think that's been, we're past that, okay? Anyway, we have a jammed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Hunter Walker, White House correspondent for Yahoo News, who together with Jonna Winter reported that the FBI is monitoring groups on the border that are protesting U.S. immigration policy. And that I talked with Hunter just a few days ago, and it's a really, really interesting interview. All right, you learn a lot off of this. Before that, we'll be talking with Dar Jamail on the climate emergency. And Dar has been covering the impacts of climate change for Truth Out for several years, and he's written a book called The End of Ice. And we'll be talking with Dar about what's happening now and what's it looking like in the world right now for human beings having to live in a climate emergency. Before that, though, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Andy Z. Andy is a co-initiator of Refuse Fascism, and he's also involved in the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour. And well, we're going to be talking about what's going on around the country, but also an upcoming event that's happening here.
This interview with Andy Z took place on Friday, September 20th, the day of historic actions against the climate crisis. Andy mentioned a program that he was participating in Los Angeles. As you're listening to this, that program has already happened, and you can go to my Facebook page to check out the video and reactions to that program.
Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Michael. How are you doing?
Good, and you?
All right, we're getting ready.
Yeah.
We're getting ready.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, let's start now with letting people know that you are what you're getting ready for, that you're going to be in town this coming week, talking about as part of a town hall. When do you say enough? Tell people what this event is about just to get started.
All of us are going to be talking about this question of why this is fascism and what needs to be done about it. And while we're all, I think, have a basic agreement that this is fascism, we're going to get into why that is so. I hope we have a robust discussion between us, because I'm sure that within our agreement, there's going to be lots of things that we're going to tussle over in terms of how do we get rid of it? How do we, what is it going to require of the people? And why must we do this now?
Yeah, you know, it's really important that, one, just the subject of this forum coming up, but also just what you were just saying. I mean, you know, this point about the event speaking about how we must not reassure ourselves that it couldn't happen here. And actually, there is quite a bit of that going on. I mean, the fight to get people out in the streets, you know, look, it's very important that people, and very uplifting that people have gone and are going into the streets now around this, you know, what's happening with the environment and all this other stuff. But there's also a bigger question here in terms of people recognizing, look, you know, It's not a well-received, or it's not a, you know, people might just sort of look at you and say whatever, you know, yeah, okay. But this idea, it's more than an idea that fascism is storming the palace, basically. I mean, fascism is actually coming up and, you know, and it's actually taking root. And people are not paying enough attention to that or seeing it or refuse to see it. And I'd like to talk with that, because you guys have been actually very, very much on the front line of actually trying to bring this to people and bringing it out to people in the myriad ways it shows itself, but that gets even more important today.
Yeah, well, it's important that people understand what they're facing and they'll act on what they understand. And I think there's a tremendous amount of dread in society right now about this regime. But it's coupled with, you know, a situation in this country where people are confronting. It's kind of an irony and stuff. They're confronting a fascist regime. On the one hand, they don't want to accept it as fascist. On the other hand, they're somewhat intimidated by it. At the same time, because of the fact that America sits on the top of the pile in the world and is the leading empire, the sole superpower, people have a relatively comfortable life. And that the fascism right now is directly hitting millions of people, but there's tens and hundreds of millions of people who aren't in America, who aren't directly affected, and they are consumed with their own lives, and a lot of the individualism that permeates this society is signified and epitomized by the selfie. This is something that Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has pointed out, and they are pursuing the elections as a way of painless progress that is going to really not only do nothing, but actually is both irresponsible and immoral at this time when we're facing such an urgent danger, and in that sense is doing harm and reflects this complicity with what is actually going on, which I'd like to actually get into a little bit. Maybe we could even talk about this wonderful strike that's going on today by students around the world and the threat that we face.
Yeah, let's talk about that now. Actually, I'd really like to get into that. I think because I think especially in terms of, look, the need for people to stand up. And I have a couple other questions of what you just said, but we can get into them a little bit later. But it actually all comes into, look, there's a need for people to stand up, to understand what's going on, to figure out how they're going to, you know, what do they need to do? What's it going to take to actually stop all this, you know, the rise of fascism, basically the bringing of fascism into the ball game in a legitimate way and all this stuff. Let's talk about this because it's a critical question for people to get into.
Yeah, well, you know, in answering the question of why this is fascism, it's an incredible congruence of events just in the last 24 hours and going on right now. The congruence, or the coming together of the threatened war against Iran, the ratcheting up of the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, Saudi Arabia being the U.S. ally and U.S. saying they're the guarantor they want to be the guarantor of what happens in the Middle East, and the student strike around the environment. You know, this really poses a lot of very important questions. Both of these questions concentrate existential questions, meaning the survival of humanity, the threatened war against Iran, and the devastation of the environment. And I won't go into too much on the environment since you're going to have Jar on after me, and he can talk about the kinds of things he's been drawing attention to, like 10% of the world population won't have water in the imminent future. So there are these kinds of questions. But look, there's two things that come together around this: the environment and the war against Iran, both of which, as I said, are existential. But I do pose, one, the enormous immediate danger of the Trump-Pence fascist regime in their denial of scientific consensus and fact that they've reversed every single climate initiative they can get their bloody hands on, and their drive for America first, threatening war and even nuclear war, with the threats against Iran being incredibly dangerous, and they are walking tightrope now where things can get set in motion from which there is no retreat on both sides. And this would be one can't overestimate the damage and the danger of this kind of thing. So there's the question of the Trump-Pence fascist regime has exacerbated both of these contradictions, you know, pulling out of the Iran Accord and all this. We don't have the time to get into all the details of this. But at the same time, you know, as you mentioned, that I'm on this tour whose title is, you know, you think you're woke, but you're sleepwalking through a nightmare. This system can't be reformed. We need to overthrow the system. And if you actually think about this, the system itself is responsible for the situation with the environment. And you cannot fix the environment within the confines of the capitalist imperialist system, because this is a system that is based on the relentless drive to profit, which depends on ever more efficient, which means ever more ruthless exploitation of people here and around the world, and the ever more ruthless exploitation of the environment and the basic resources of the world. And that you can't just fix this. And even things like the New Green Deal talk about ways to deal with climate change, but within the confines of U.S. still staying number one and in the world. And let's be clear that the U.S. military is the largest single institutional user of fossil fuels. So this is a system that does that, and the same dynamic towards profit that drives it to destroy the earth is also the same dynamic that it leads it to continually go to war. And these are two of the five stops that we give attention to in the revolution tour that are things that this system does that they can't fix and that are reasons to make a revolution. But there's actually a third, and let me just say something about that. Where we're headed in climate change is one where millions and tens of millions, maybe as many as 100 million people in the global south are going to need to flee their countries just to be able to have food and water and to survive the kind of climate change that's happening. And what is happening in the U.S. and in Europe? They're building walls, putting up concentration camps, and pointing guns, ultimately, at people. And so this is the kind of future that we're looking at here, and that's the third stop of the five stops, which is the xenophobia, the persecution, the detention, and deportation of immigrants. So look, and this is something that's true of both parties, but we do have to get to the difference between them. We say on the Revolution Tour, the Republican Party is fascist, but the Democratic Party is a party of war crimes and crimes against humanity. So look, that gives you a sense of what we're facing, and we don't have that much time today to get into it, but I would commend to people to look at the Constitution for a New Socialist Republic in North America, authored by Bob Avakian, that brings forward a whole different way under a different system that you could organize society and actually deal with the problems of the environment. And I say deal with them, they're difficult problems, but this Constitution talks about how you would create a society not based on profit, where there could be increasing cooperation and common endeavor with scientists and people from all walks of life and in every part of the world to join together and struggle together to overcome the barriers that are leading to the destruction of the environment and what would be necessary, the kind of economy you would need to has as one of its foundational principles, the sustainable Earth. But in the immediate situation, to even get to that world, we have to drive this regime out of power. And whether you believe in that the system, as I do, must be overthrown ultimately to get to a just world, or if you believe that America has the potential within its current foundation and governing structures to be a force for good, for any sense of justice here around the world, there has to be a mass movement of millions of people to drive this regime out. And that's what we're going to be talking about at the town hall. And prior to that, Michael, over the next 2 weeks, which is why I'm staying in Los Angeles, we are in Refuse Fascism, calling for in late October to start protests like in Hong Kong, like in Puerto Rico, the kinds of things that were done in South Korea. But take Hong Kong, where not a continuation of what people have been doing here, just fighting around the different aspects of things, as righteous as that is, the different aspects of attacks, immigrants, climate, mass incarceration, but actually getting into the streets week after week, eventually becoming day after day, millions of people in cities across the country. This is what we're proposing. We want all kinds of people to find out about this. You can go to Refuse Fascism. That's refusefascism.org. to find out more details about the kickoff meeting in Washington this Sunday, the meeting in Los Angeles next Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a couple more questions for you. And one is, you know, as you were talking, I kept thinking about, okay, you're beginning to talk about something that I really wanted to ask you about, but it's also, there's a morality involved here, but there's also a real, you know, basically materialist assessment of things where for people to not act today, for people to act like it's just a matter of getting the right, you know, getting the, you know, Green New Deal or getting this, you know, getting a you know, sympathetic person into office, all this kind of stuff. That's actually not just not going to do anything, but it's actually doing bad things in terms of that. And I think this point about to not act in the way that's needed is actually does add up to, and people have to face this, to not act in the face of all this does add up to complicity. And we need to, you know, there does need to be a uniting of all people who can be united to stop this fascist wave. And to do that, there has to be some understanding of this doesn't mean, you know, jumping into the Democratic Party's, you know, fest.
Yeah, I mean, look, it is complicity. It's not that people don't know what's going on. There are concentration camps on the border. Millions of people know that children were separated from their parents and kept in cages. People were going to rely on the courts to change this and to fix this. The courts ruled against the Trump administration, against this fascist regime. But they continue to do it. And in fact, they control the courts at this point. This is where you see that an essential part of fascism is dispensing with the normal political and civil norms that exist in a society and going to a more open and blatant form of rule that relies on the single executive and the repressive arms of the state and organized and disorganized people, thugs, who are fascists. And so this is where you're seeing this uptick in, which is quite brutal, of mass murders being conducted behind essentially the Trump agenda. there's a recent piece by Bob Avakian that Refused Fascism is used, and the Rev Tours, Revolution Tour is using, where he said, if you will not take to the streets now to demand the Trump-Pence regime must go, even after all of these outrages, what will you do if Trump is reelected? And what will you do if Trump loses the election but then refuses to recognize the results and insists he is still president? And so you see, waiting till 2020, then you're making a calculation that you're willing to have these tens of thousands of people in camps and all the things, risking war around the world, all these kinds of things. They should just go on. But then what are you going to do in this situation if he wins? What are you going to do if he refuses to leave? And frankly, without a mass movement of millions and millions of people ultimately, but it's certainly starting with thousands and thousands, creating the kind of political situation that can't be ignored. Even if you get someone in, all these fascist forces are still going to be there, and they're still going to be doing what they do. And you're going to have a, you know, people say Trump is dividing society. Trump is not dividing society. Society is divided because of the underlying problems the system faces. And there's a powerful section of the rulers of this country, and there's a powerful social base numbering over 30 million people with their own TV misinformation network, Fox News. I shouldn't say misinformation, it's a fascist network, that that are organized. If we could get in the streets with this kind of movement, again, people who believe in the system and people who don't, but all of whom are opposed to this fascism, we would create a different dynamic of society, including that if we compel the removal of Trump, you want to have forces in the street that are going to compel the removal of Pence, and actually are going to question the whole setup, because you do have the courts already packed. You do have Congress, the Senate dominated by the Republicans. You do have most of the state legislatures dominated by the fascists. You do have this fascist structure running all through the police and military forces in this country. You have to actually, if the people's will is going to be expressed, it's going to have to be expressed by the people themselves. We need the power of the people to be arrayed against the power of this empire. And if you did that, then some of these people in the Democratic Party leadership and others in Congress who will not act without this force in the streets that's actually demanding this in an unrelenting way, the way they are in Hong Kong, they are not going to act. But if we are in the streets, then there could be the compulsion to save their own system and their own interests to remove Trump and Pence and the entire regime and gain initiative for every struggle for justice, including, from my point of view and for the tour that I'm working on, for the possibility of building and organizing forces for the time when we could actually overthrow the whole system.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy, we've just run out of time, so I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Dar Jamail. Really looking forward to this one as well. Right, Earthquake in the Heart of Rome. All right, someday I'll play that entire song and then everybody will be playing it. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show. And, you know, I'm always trying to figure out a way, how do I get him to be on the show on a regular basis, okay? And it's Dar Jamail, and we're going to be talking with Dar about his climate emergency and how he's been covering the impacts of climate change for Truth Out for several years. And he's the author of the book End of Ice. His most recent articles detail the impacts of climate disruption, including sea level rise on billions of people. His articles and more can be found in Climate Disruption Dispatches. Dar, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Michael. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, man. Well, as I was saying, it's the way things are shaping up in the world today. It's a question of people really got to step up to the front, you know, and that's something I think you really always challenge people in terms of, you put in front of them what the real situation is, and then they have to figure out what they're going to do in relation to that. And I'd say this: you begin your recent article with two examples of how far things have gone in relation to the destruction of the planet. You know, Greenland and the Amazon rainforest. Give people a sense of how dire the situation is right now.
Well, it is important, I think, for the context of whatever we have the conversation about, the climate crisis, that people start understanding that, you know, there's been so many of these future worst case predictions and all of this, and, you know, and all of these stand, but we have to understand that we are already into a system where there's by so many scientists observations that probably at a minimum of 3 degrees C warming that's already baked into the system no matter what happens. And that means that feedback loops like Greenland and the Amazon are playing out in real time. These are things that had long since been predicted to be off in the future, where the Amazon passes certain tipping points and through deforestation and wildfires and other impacts, that essentially the brunt of the largest rainforest on the planet turns into a savanna. We're looking at that happen right now. These wildfires that are happening, for example, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who's studied the Amazon since 1965, really one of the preeminent experts on biodiversity on the planet, actually wrote an article about a year ago and said, look, we've already lost about 5% of the Amazon, and if we lose another 5%, I'm afraid that we'll have crossed a tipping point where the brunt of it turns into savanna. And we have just lost another 5% with these wildfires. And then when we look at the crisis in Greenland, where, you know, one of the leading experts studying Greenland up there, Dr. Jason Eric Box, and he has actually said, you know, we're essentially losing Greenland now, that there's the amount of melting, the rapidity of it that's happening so far ahead of what he and other scientists had even thought about, worried about, warned about a few years ago as something further off into the future. And now it's happening right now in front of our eyes. And so we're basically looking at these runaway feedback loops that are kicking into overdrive as we speak.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamil, and we're talking about what the hell is going on with the environment in the world, what's happening now. You know, now, Dar, one of the things I wanted to, you know, it's really, you know, I went through so much of what you've written, and I was just blown away by it. And there's things that, you know, when you're talking about things like, some people, I don't know how people could possibly look at this and think, okay, this isn't real. Because you're talking about things like, okay, Greenland facing a melting death. You're talking about record wildfires in the Amazon rainforest, you know, and how the UN's chief of biodiversity even warned that the burning of the Amazon could lead to cascading collapses of natural systems across the planet. This is a very heavy situation, and it's a matter of life and death for the entire planet, not just the people that are in it, but the entire planet.
Well, it really is, and I mean, I'm glad that you put that way that you did, because that is precisely what's happening. The systems of the planet, which of course we always have and do and always would depend on for our lives, unraveling in front of our faces. And while that's happening, instead of governments reacting to the emergency as they should, and this is not, more of the context is, this is not under the guise that we're going to stop it or change it. And I think at this point, even slowing it down a little bit would basically be the best case scenario. And that basically means surrendering to the fact that we're not going to stop it. We are living on an irrevocably changed planet, and the odds of human species going extinct are quite high at this point. In fact, it's pretty hard to see it not going that direction with what's baked into the system. And it would take us a long time to unpack that and describe why I and I think a lot of scientists feel pretty confident in saying that, but we have to understand the gravity of the crisis, and that if governments in a best case scenario say responded to these climate strikes that are happening as we speak, which are beautiful, powerful gestures as far as them actually forcing governments in a globe who's basically most of the economy is tied to the fossil fuel industry and will not run without it, and think that those governments are actually going to take the radical changes necessary to even begin to mitigate this it's just not living in reality. And I think that's another part of these hard realities that we have to accept. And then it comes down to, how do we choose to comport ourselves during this time? You know, if we're in a crisis, we're in an emergency situation, there doesn't appear to be anything that's going to happen to change it. Are we still willing to go do the right thing and fight like our lives depend on it, and really let go of the results of those actions completely?
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. You know, it's because, you know, I want to run through a couple of things that you point out to people. The ocean's heating up across the Pacific. There's a, you know, people can say, okay, well, the ocean's heating up, you know, so what? It all, you know, it gets warm, it gets whatever. But there's actually, there's a process there that's actually part of pushing things in the direction that we don't want to see the world go into, but it is going into. So let's talk about the oceans heating up across the Pacific. And then contrasted with that, and you began to spoke to this earlier, Alaska's sea ice is completely melted for the first time in recorded history. That seems to be a, you know, one of those like, wow, wait a minute, what moments, you know?
Well, exactly. And I'm glad you bring up the warm water in the global oceans, because that is a core component to understanding how much heat is already baked into the system and how much warming in the future is baked into the system, even if we stopped all CO2 on emissions on a dime today. The last 5 years in a row, each year has been a record warm year for oceanic warming. They've absorbed 93% of all the heat that we've added into the atmosphere, half of that since just 1997. If they hadn't absorbed all that heat, our current atmospheric temperatures would be a little over 90 degrees hotter than they are right now as we speak. So we're talking about an enormous amount of energy. And so all of that is in the oceans, and that's why we're seeing these ice sheets in the western Antarctic melting from below. Anywhere where there's sea ice and anywhere where there's glaciers terminating into oceans, all of that is essentially melting away before our eyes, because not just from warmer atmospheric temperatures, but particularly from the warming happening below. And that's why a big study that came out from the Antarctica about the Thwaites Glacier, a huge glacier there, actually found that it had been melting so extensively from below that there was a 1,000-foot-high empty cavity underneath the surface of the glacier. Literally, there's just nothing left. It's melting so fast from below, and it's about to collapse. So that's what's happening, and that you can't take that heat out of the oceans. You know, you hear people talking about geoengineering and some of these other kind of scientific, fantastical, imaginary solutions, and you know, no matter what you're going to talk about for solutions, you cannot remove that heat from the oceans. And so that's another, I think, hard reality that people need to understand when we look at the kind of world that we're living in now. And as far as the sea ice, this is an extremely alarming crisis, as you pointed out, because the shallow seas of the Arctic, right underneath those is submerged permafrost, which contains methane hydrates, which is a far more potent greenhouse gas than a CO2 on a 10-year time scale. It's actually nearly 100 times more potent, and the shallow Arctic seabed is loaded with it, enough so that once it starts releasing en masse, and scientists I've spoken with feel like that process has already begun. We haven't seen a cataclysmic immediate release all at once, as some scientists like Natalia Shikova has warned about in her papers, but that threat looms. Nevertheless, we are seeing an increase of methane in the atmosphere. There is a lot of science now trying to figure it out. Yes, a lot of it is due to the explosion of fracking around the planet, but now eyes are turning more towards the Arctic, and I've written about this extensively. NASA has reported on this and done studies on it, and I think now the general public's about to understand why so many of us have been giving these warnings for so long.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, too, that actually sort of struck me when I'm looking at it, and it's one thing to have read about the oceans and about what's happening around the world, and then you had a thing in this article where you talked about the Great Lakes and flooding events and how that has really become a major factor in the country today. Let's talk about that.
Well, that's right. And look at Houston today. I mean, this small little tropical depression blew up right off the coast of Galveston and then moved very slowly inland. And this was the kind of thing that in the wake of Hurricane Harvey there a couple of years ago that people warned about, that these giant, slow-moving, moisture-laden systems were going to become more the norm. And it's the same up in the Great Lakes, and it's the same in other places around the world where the atmosphere is so much warmer, can hold so much more moisture. There's less differentiation in temperature differences in certain areas, and that's why systems are now oftentimes moving so much more slowly. So they're just drenching these areas with record-setting amounts of rain in extremely short periods of time. And this is the norm, and this is why flooding, and then oftentimes followed by extreme amounts of drought, and then followed by extreme amounts of flooding, like this is really the new normal now with a climate-disrupted planet.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamil. And we're talking about what the hell is happening with the world. And actually, there's a big question posed for a lot of people of what you're going to do in the face of this. Now, Dar, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, is that sort of in the middle of all this, there's a question that comes up, which is really very important. And that, you know, this question about the lack of water and food insecurity, because you're talking about, you're starting to look at bigger figures than just sort of the things of what's happening around the, you know, the ice, what's happening in other places. But you're looking at these big figures of people, actual human beings, and hundreds of thousands of them that are suffering terribly and will be suffering even more in greater numbers as this progresses.
That's right. I mean, if we just simply look at the fact, you know, considering what we've just talked about cursorily regarding how much heat's in the oceans, how much warming is baked into the system, and the amount of ice being lost in Antarctica and Greenland, and the amount of sea level rise. I mean, there's several studies based on paleoclimate data that show last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, sea levels range anywhere from 18 meters to 40 meters higher than they are right now. One of the sea level rise experts I interviewed for my book said the same thing, basically that last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, sea levels were 130 feet higher than they are right now. So if that's what's baked into the system, that means literally every coastal city on the planet, and many of these are the biggest cities on the planet, like New York, Tokyo, Los Angeles, et cetera, are gone. So the question is, where do all those people go? So we can really just use your imagination a little bit and understand that the question is not if, it's when. And so what are you going to do? For example, you know, we just saw the Bahamas wiped out by a huge hurricane. Why are they even going to rebuild there? And if you're really looking soberly at the climate crisis and being honest with yourself about what this means for the future, every time there's an extreme event like that in a vulnerable area, whether it's there or Paradise, California, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it does not make sense to rebuild.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dar, we have time for one more question here, and I got so many left. Let's talk about denial and reality, because the Trump administration is actively censoring climate science. And I want to talk about that because it's really something that people have to face up to, that there's actually a need to fight against what's being done by this fascist regime and what's being done in terms of, and what can be done or what needs to be done in terms of people standing up against that.
Well, it comes down to what we touched on earlier, that I think it's, what is more valiant and honorable and moral than standing up and fighting back and resisting and doing the right thing, even though we understand that, look, we're not going to stop these catastrophes from happening. We're, you know, odds are, best case scenario, maybe we would slow it down a little bit, and yet standing up and doing the right thing anyway. And to me, it's, you know, it's either that or sit around and wallow in depression and self-pity. And in reality, I think it's a very, very important time for us to have our turn at standing up and really fighting and doing the right thing, whether that means for political change or for protecting a piece of the earth that has yet to be desecrated by this industrial growth society.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dar, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. Always good to be with you.
Yeah, and we'll stay in touch because I'm sure there's a lot more to talk about in the future. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dar Jamil, and we've been talking about what the hell is going on with the climate, and what are we facing, and what can be done, all right? We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
Earthquake in the heart of Rome. Earthquake in the heart of Rome. Earthquake in the heart of Rome. Earthquake in the heart of Rome.
I recently read an article on Yahoo News that really sort of smacked me around. It was titled, "The FBI Tracking Border Protest Groups as Extremist Organizations." And it was written by Hunter Walker and Jana Winner. And Hunter Walker is a journalist who's here to talk with us today about just what the hell is going on here. Hunter, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this because I got so many questions, man. You know, it's interesting because you're looking at this, and I don't think people realize how much is actually going on today, as what we're looking at overall is sort of the bringing in of a much more fascistic society in a certain way, where there's all these kinds of operations of police operations that are actually just sort of piling up, and it becomes accepted if nobody says anything about it. And you actually, you and your partner actually had this found or ran into something about the FBI using basically tracking border protest groups as extremist organizations. Tell me what you found there. What led you to this and what you found?
Right. Well, first off, I'll start with, you know, just what we found in this instance. And, you know, it was a document called an external intelligence note. In this case, it was generated by the FBI's Phoenix office. And, you know, the Bureau and the note itself was very careful to say, you know, this is just the opinion of the Phoenix office. But, you know, these notes are distributed very, very widely. And it also described both the office's opinions, but also intelligence that had been gathered by other agencies, namely the Department of Homeland Security. And it made clear that they are, through human sources, which, you know, can either be informants or undercover people, it's not necessarily clear, and also through social media monitoring and other measures, including just online tracking, you know, really looking at border protest groups. They are framing this as an extremist threat. And in this note, they were saying that, you know, there's rising risk that these groups could try to obtain firearms and use lethal force. What was problematic about it was every instance they cited in this note was nonviolent protest. You know, in one case, they cited a single tweet from an activist where he talked about shutting down ICE that seemed very clear to be typical left-wing rhetoric and was not really a violent threat. In another instance, they cited this digital magazine that kind of wrapped up protest actions that had occurred in Arizona from 2011 until more recently. And some of these included things like hanging banners, one event that was hosted by a local Presbyterian church. So, you know, a lot of this just didn't seem to measure up to the kind of threat they were casting it as. But one thing, you know, that I would say is, you know, I would dispute your point a little bit that this is a new phenomenon. We talked to experts who were very concerned about this, but they very much put it in sort of a larger history of government policing and monitoring of protest groups, going all the way back to COINTELPRO. And, you know, one of the guys we spoke with was pointing to this 2010 Inspector General report where the FBI had been criticized for something very similar to this, where they were trying to make the case that PETA and Greenpeace and other sort of environmental groups were a very dangerous extremist threat, and everything they were pointing to in that instance was nonviolent as well.
Yeah, I really agree with you. Given the background I came from in terms of being involved in the 60s and stuff, I'm really aware of the kind of bloody bull that the harm that the FBI and all these other agents do when they are in, you know, going after people that are, you know, especially going after progressive people who seem to be standing up against the oppression of the government. And it's sort of, it's a very heavy thing when you look at this. And when I was looking at what you were talking about, you know, even this external intelligence note, give people a little bit more of a sense of what that is and what do they claim that it actually reveals?
Right. So an external intelligence note is basically something that one intelligence agency office will make summarizing their conclusions about something that is then, as I said, distributed widely. And in this case, it was distributed widely within the FBI. And the sort of top line conclusion from it was that these groups are, quote, and this is a direct quote, increasingly arming themselves and using lethal force to further their goals. But again, and this is me talking now, almost all of the evidence cited in the report included nonviolent activity. They did point to, you know, one group called Redneck Revolt, which I am sort of aware of. It has a chapter that I've actually encountered myself in Phoenix called the John Brown Gun Club that is sort of, it's what we would traditionally understand as a militia, but it's a left-wing one. And they do carry guns. So you know, they could be seen as a violent group, but, you know, they maintain that all of their activities are defensive. They also claimed that there was this Antifa training event, and I found what seemed to be the event that they were referring to, and they said that this event involved firearms training. You know, I can't verify that or not, but I can tell you that everything on the group's website talked about engaging in defensive activity. But, you know, the bulk of this stuff that was cited in this note reaching such a dramatic conclusion was nonviolent activity. I mean, you know, when I mentioned that report to you where it was sort of an online magazine citing over, you know, 40 instances of protests that had occurred from 2011 to 2018, God, I think it was like two or three of them were more dramatic things like skirmishes at protests or vandalism. And the rest were really, really pedestrian. I mean, literally banner hanging and marching was some of the stuff cited in there.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you point out in your piece is you say that the FBI guidelines dictate, actually, even though all this stuff is going on that you're talking about, their guidelines dictate that investigations must be conducted within constitutional and statutory parameters, and that civil liberties and privacy have to be protected. And there's a history of that kind of rule being ignored going back decades and decades, but also even more currently, as you were pointing out earlier. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit more, if you can develop that a little.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I just want to, I'm pulling up my own story here. The online magazine I was talking about was 20 pages long. It covered 50 events, and they cited less than 20 words from the magazine to make their point. And the words they cited included encouragement to readers to find quote-unquote relevant targets in your town. And that language of targets can sound really sinister unless you actually read the whole 20-page publication, and it makes it clear that they're talking about, you know, targets for civil disobedience. But to go back to what you were saying about sort of the constitutional and statutory requirements for FBI investigations, you know, a lot of experts that we talked to, including former FBI special agents, we're saying, first off, that history of policing protests that I was referencing before is in a way a natural thing for government because, you know, it's natural for the government to take a distrustful view of its own critics. And that's why we have some of these safeguards in place. And it's really hard not to see potential for a document like the one that, you know, was leaked to us. And also like some of the stuff that was criticized in the 2010 report I mentioned earlier as, you know, a effort to trump up and create a legal basis and rationale for policing groups that doesn't seem entirely fair. And one of the things these experts kept pointing to, it's, you know, we sort of had two companion pieces in the past month or so, and one was based on another report leaked to us from the FBI, or it might have been Homeland Security, but it showed that the government has tracked data showing that last year, almost all of the individuals involved in incidents of domestic terrorism were white supremacists. And that was really interesting because that's specific data that members of Congress have requested, how many white supremacists are involved in attempted or alleged terrorist incidents. And the government has not been willing to provide it, but we showed that they'd actually tabulated exactly that. So, you know, a lot of these activists and experts that we've talked to are concerned that it seems like the government is downplaying the white supremacist threat while overplaying the threat from protest groups.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Hunter Walker, White House correspondent for Yahoo News, and we're talking about how the FBI is monitoring groups on the border that are protesting U.S. immigration policy. Yeah, in fact, that's one of the things I was just going to ask you about, because you also talk about how the FBI describes the border protests as coming from anarchist extremists and dedicated to increasing armed conflict with the U.S. government. And I wanted to talk about that because, you know, one thing, there's another place where you actually show people basically being pretty mild, and you know, you've already spoken to some of that, and we'll get into it a little bit more. But it's people who are dedicated to resistance to what's going on in the society today, resistance to what's happening to immigrants, all of these kinds of things, and actually saying no to the rise of fascism. And the result of that is the FBI describing that they are anarchist extremists dedicated to increasing armed conflict, and never say a damn thing about all of the various yahoos that are out there with their weapons and their bows and arrows and their whatevers, you know, going after people that they just figured shouldn't be allowed on the face of the earth.
Now, right, and just to be clear, this one note detailing what they see as the quote-unquote extremist threat from border protest groups just dealt with that topic. So, you know, when I say that there is other documents and other concern that the FBI is downplaying the white supremacist threat, you know, that's sort of more about the Bureau's activities writ large. This note wouldn't necessarily have included that. But what I found sort of interesting about that, I mean, I don't want to sugarcoat it, right? Mm-hmm. We live in it's a very heated climate right now, you know, and we've seen incidents like the congressional baseball shooting. I was out right in the aftermath of that near here in Alexandria. We've seen things like these left-wing militia groups emerging that I'm talking to you about, you know, there has been violence associated with the left and protest groups, but it is not on the scale, and again, you know, we have obtained the government's own data, it is not on the scale of what we're seeing from these far-right groups and white supremacist groups. So the question is whether or not the response is proportionate. And one thing that I found really, really interesting, I mean, you know, you said right at the top of the conversation that some of the stuff that we were not aware is going on, and I certainly think that I had not been aware that the government was doing this kind of aggressive monitoring of protest groups. But when I reached out to some of the activists who were cited in the note, they were not surprised that the government was monitoring them. In one case, this guy whose single tweet talking about shutting down ICE was referenced, he was like, yeah, I got a Fed visit. They knocked on my door. This one border group that told me that all they do is humanitarian aid told me that they were not surprised because members of sort of a faction that they were associated with were on these lists that had been obtained by another reporter showing that government was monitoring these people. So, you know, I feel like there's a lot of stuff going on right now. And, you know, you're seeing in the protest space Antifa and other liberal groups that are very actively engaging both with the government and also with these far-right and white supremacist groups. They're in conflict with each other, and they are aware that they're being tracked. But I think that, by and large, the public who is participating in women's marches and maybe donating money to help people for asylum is not realizing that that group, that type of, you know, more mainstream protest activity is being considered by the government potentially extremist and lumped into some of this more dramatic stuff.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, I just want to go back to something else you were saying, because I do think that, well, you know, yes, there's all kinds of groups out there on the left who are there and who are doing different things. But for the most part, I think actually there's a spot in your article where you're talking to one young guy who is sort of, he's kind of huffing a lot and puffing a lot and you know, you get a sense if he's actually, okay, he starts saying one thing, and then all of a sudden when you start talking to him, he's sort of backing up. And there's a question, yes, there are people who are, I think, you know, in terms of the left, who have actually different ideas than everyone else. But I think that really what's being attacked right now, and especially given the way, and I think you were speaking to this, but I wanted to go over it again because it's really important, given the way that the FBI and the system is coming down on people at the border, people trying to cross the border. I mean, I was just at a Penn event the other night, and these two people that were, one woman who was going back and forth on the border, and she would get stopped and she was held for hours, a reporter, you know, and it was all of these things that were really aimed at basically sort of dehumanizing the immigrant people, dehumanizing immigrants, dehumanizing people who are other than us that fit into the society, you know. And it's interesting because even with the part that you were talking about around the FBI, when there's this whole question of, you know, basically what are they doing and who are they going after, you know, they act like, and you present different stories about this, but they act like it's none of your business and we're doing this because it's demanded by the good of society. And this is the kind of thing that really kind of is just steps away from, you know, round up the Jews and put them on the buses.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're a pretty mainstream news organization. The report that I was referencing before that caused some of these activists to be aware that they were being monitored, where it described, you know, a list of activists who were being tracked by the government. I believe that was a local broadcast affiliate somewhere out there in the Southwest. I think NBC, if I'm correct. So these are, you know, we're mainstream news organizations that are finding documents that are detailing this surveillance. And in the case of the document that we came across, as I said earlier, it detailed surveillance using human sources. So that would either be informants or undercover work, and also social media monitoring. So that's, you know, pretty aggressive and heavy surveillance for, in many of the instances, again, detailed in the government's own document, that were nonviolent. That's in seemingly almost apparent contrast to what's going on with white supremacist groups in the far right. And I just pulled up the earlier story that we had done on that. And, you know, there's a couple things going on with that, right? Basically, that story showed another document that detailed, quote-unquote, race-based groups who were responsible for incidents of domestic terrorism last year. And what some Democrats in Congress have raised concerns about is that the classification system law enforcement is using for domestic terrorism has actually gotten more obscure. It went from 11 categories down to, I think, 4, right? So this category of race-based is actually new. The government used to say black identity extremists. They used to say white supremacists, right? They turned it into something vaguer. And once they turned it into something vaguer, and we found this underlying data, it showed that the quote-unquote race-based category only included white supremacists. So it's a really interesting thing where we are seeing this aggressive surveillance of protest groups. And again, as I was saying to you earlier, we are also seeing what seems to be attempts to diminish the activities of the far right and white supremacists. So, you know, getting back to what we were talking about, where these types of documents and this type of data is what's used to create the legal rationale to justify this type of surveillance, right? The proportionality of the response becomes really important, because it's basically, what are they doing to say who might have someone reading their emails, reading their social media, who might have someone trying to infiltrate their group? Certainly, liberal activists and experts are very concerned that it seems like the government is only aimed in one direction.
Mm-hmm. All right, Hunter Walker, our time is up, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Sure, and I'll look for your stories more and more and talk to you again, man.
I'd love to do it.
All right, that was Hunter Walker, White House correspondent for Yahoo News, on the FBI monitoring groups on the border that are protesting U.S. immigration policy. We have some time left, so I'd like to play a piece by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a new synthesis of communism. This is Bob Avakian on revolution and the fight against fascism, and it's from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution.
To come back then to the most fundamental point, all this is aiming for something very definite, a revolutionary situation. What we are doing now is making revolution. It is all part of and must be consciously and systematically carried out as an overall strategic plan and approach to getting to the point where millions can be brought forward to wage the all-out fight to overthrow this system with a real chance of winning. A great immediate challenge that bears heavily on the prospects for revolution is what is represented by the Trump-Pence regime. In another talk, the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. I have spoken to how this is in fact a fascist regime, the basis on which it has risen to power in this country. How, so long as it remains in power, this regime will commit ever greater atrocities and poses a very real threat to the future and very existence of humanity through its assaults on the environment and its arsenals of nuclear annihilation. And why, in the name of humanity, it is necessary and how it is possible to force the removal of this regime through a massive, nonviolent, but sustained mobilization of people demanding that this regime must go. Here I'm going to speak to the relation between this and the fundamental goal of revolution. If this regime is able to further consolidate its power and more fully implement its horrific agenda, the prospects for revolution could then be greatly set back, and the conscious revolutionary forces decimated or completely destroyed, at least for a time. On the other hand, if a mass movement is built to drive out this regime, and if the revolutionaries work to build this movement from the perspective of how it relates to the revolution that is needed as the fundamental solution, then the situation in society and the world will become much more favorable for the fight against injustice and oppression, and crucial advances can be made toward the overthrow of the whole system. To a significant degree now, the conflict between the sections of society upholding this fascism and those opposing it from various different perspectives is shaping the terrain on which the struggle for revolution must be carried out. This conflict is likely to intensify and could erupt further in violent confrontation. And in any case, it would be a significant factor in the context of an all-out struggle between revolution and counter-revolution. The relation between the struggle against this fascist regime and building the revolution is not a straight road or a one-way street. It must not be approached by those who understand the need for revolution, as if first we must build a mass movement to drive out this regime, and then we can turn our attention to working directly for revolution. No. It is crucial to unite and mobilize people from different perspectives, very broadly, around the demand that this regime must go. But it will be much more difficult to do this on the scale and with the determination that is required to meet this objective if there are not, at the same time, greater and greater numbers of people who have been brought forward around the understanding that it is necessary to put an end not only to this regime, but to the system out of whose deep and defining contradictions this regime has arisen, a system which by its very nature has imposed and will continue to impose horrific and completely unnecessary suffering on the masses of humanity until this system itself is abolished. And the more that people are brought forward to be consciously, actively working for a revolution, the growing strength and moral authority of this revolutionary force will in turn strengthen the resolve of growing numbers of people to drive out this fascist regime now in power, even as many will not be, and some will perhaps never be, won to revolution. So, both to meet the immediate challenge of creating a political situation in which this regime will be removed from power, and in which the political initiative has been seized to a great degree by those who are determined to turn back the assault on humanity that is being carried out by this regime and to strive for a better world, however they understand that, and to advance toward the fundamental goal of revolution, it is vitally important that all those who have come to understand the need for revolution actively contribute to building the movement to drive out this regime and do so from the perspective and in the overall framework of building for revolution.
That was Bob Avakian on revolution and the fight against fascism, and it's taken from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And you can find that piece by Bob Avakian on revcom.us. All right, welcome back. As I'm sitting here and listening to this, and I kept thinking, we've got to talk about what the hell is going on right now. And people have to understand that we must not reassure ourselves that it can't happen here. It is. Trump's Make America Great Again is the 21st century fascist program of manifest destiny, nothing less. America first, wrapped in the flag and Mike Pence's Bible taken literally, with a program of white supremacy, misogyny, and xenophobia. And if you will not take to the streets now to demand that the Trump-Pence regime must go, even after all these outrages, what will you do if Trump is reelected? What are you going to do if Trump loses the election but then refuses to recognize the results and insists he is still president? Think about that. Think about that. Wrestle with it with your friends. People need to, really think about what they need to do in the coming weeks. And on that note, I want to thank everybody that was listening today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. And I also want to thank my board op today, Lizette Tapia. And thank you all for joining us. We're going to go out now with Here is the Rose from Outer National.